This December, millions will decorate their homes, send greeting cards, gather with friends and family, and exchange gifts, enjoy a dinner together, and not even celebrate Christmas. So what are they leaving out? And how do you make sure that you're not missing Christmas? John MacArthur has the answer next on Grace to You Weekend. The story is told of a little girl who, as her family opened presents Christmas morning, was puzzled that there wasn't a gift for the one whose birth was being commemorated. She said, "I guess everyone forgot about Jesus." And it's a point well taken. It's evident that for most of the world, Christmas has little or nothing to do with Jesus Christ. He's been forgotten. And even for Christians, the hectic pace of the holidays certainly distracts from what's important. So to keep that from happening where you live, stay with us today on Grace to You Weekend as John MacArthur shows you the people who missed Christmas. Follow along now as John revisits the biblical account of the first Christmas.
I want to share with you some thoughts on the theme, the people who missed Christmas. In spite of the media, in spite of the public relations, in spite of the advertising, and in spite of all of those things that attract our attention, it seems to me that most people will miss Christmas. But you know, as I thought about it, it's kind of because of the fact that there's so much that's cluttered up Christmas. Now, for us who know and love the Lord Jesus Christ, Christmas is a time to focus on His birth, the great reality of the Incarnation. That God became a man, that tremendous, incomprehensible miracle of divine energy that brought God into human history. We know that. But even in our own lives, because of the complexity of what is happening around us, Christmas can be lost to us in a very practical way. I think, for example, that Satan has cluttered up almost every good Christian concept with so much needless paraphernalia that it gets lost. Bible scholars know that there is absolutely no evidence at all that Christ was born on December 25th. In fact, there is not only no evidence that He was, but there is some evidence that He was not. December was the major month of pagan celebrations. December was the month of festivals and feastings and orgies and all kinds of pageants put on by the pagans in honor of their gods as winter had reached its fullness and they were anticipating the thaw and the spring and the planting and the strength of the sun returning and the clouds rolling back. And so December became a time of high, boisterous pagan revelry. Such activities, for example, are found in pagan histories in December as feasting, as adorning the homes with evergreens, as hanging trinkets on trees, as lighting candles, as involving mistletoe, as exchanging gifts, and general merrymaking and feastings deteriorated into drunkenness and orgy in these traditional heathen celebrations. Now, the thought was this. The wild winter revelries of the pagans must be sanctified by Christianity. Therefore, we will impose our celebration of the birth of Christ on the pagan celebrations and sanctify them all. It was a nice thought, but it was dead wrong. Because what happened was the heathen festivities went on. And the church was unable to make them conform to the sanctification of a true Christian celebration. And so what you have now is a strange, weird marriage of the pagan and the Christian that we call Christmas. Let me give you some illustrations. To the Romans, the month of December was important because it marked what is known as the festival of Saturnalia. Saturn was the god of agriculture. And they were then holding this great feast and involved an orgy with prostitution and all kinds of drunkenness and everything in honor of Saturn that he might begin to bring the spring so that crops could be grown. One of the common customs among the Romans at Saturnalia was giving gifts to one another, and as far as we can tell, that is where the idea of presents came from. And by the way, in the festival of Saturnalia, the most common gifts were little idols that were made in the image of the multiplicity of Roman deities. They were made out of clay, and they were made out of marble, and they were made out of silver, and they were the gifts that were given. They also were big on evergreens, which they would hang all over their houses, and that apparently is where the wreath, at least initially, came from. North of the Romans was the barbaric Northlands. The Northland people had a great celebration during December known as Yule. And in the Yule season and the Yule celebration, they honored the gods Odin and Thor. If you're from Minnesota, you understand that. Those are the people who originated in those lands. And it involved festivals, music, drinking, and so forth. To the east in Persia, at the time of December, they worshiped Mithra, the god of light. In England, to the west, the Druids, who were involved in strange priestly worship engulfing demonic and occultic powers, were gathering sacred mistletoe for their sacrifices, which they made in the month of December. Sacrifices geared toward friendship and peace. And what the Druids would do is this: they would march out into the area of the oak groves where the mistletoe grew, and they would be led by their priests in long white robes, and they would be going through their chants and their celebration. The priests would ascend into the trees with golden sickles, and they would cut down the mistletoe. And when all of the mistletoe had been gathered and passed around the people, then there would be the sacrifice of two white oxen. And the mistletoe were then to be taken back into the homes, and they were to be hung in the homes. And anytime anybody came under the mistletoe, he was to immediately embrace anyone else under there. It was an effort to reconcile people, whether they liked it or not. And that's where the mistletoe came from. The drama of the crib, which we know as the manger scene, was popularized by St. Francis in the 13th century. 300 years later, Luther picked up the idea of a Christmas tree and brought a tree into his house and put candles on it to symbolize the sparkling stars in the sky over the forest. But trees and trinkets hanging on them had been part of festivals of the pagans for centuries. Holland got into the act by giving us their favorite saint, St. Nicholas. St. Nicholas was a white-bearded bishop of Asia Minor who was such a popular old fella that when he died, it was believed that he came back every December 6th. And St. Nicholas would come back every December 6th, and he would ride through the streets on a white horse, and all the little Dutch kids would put their wooden shoes out on the porch, and as he came along, he would put goodies in the shoes of the good kids, and where there were bad children, he would leave a switch. For obvious reasons. And the Dutch called St. Nicholas Sinterklaas, and we got Santa Claus. Caroling started in the 14th century along with jesters, musicians, and mummers who went around with funny masks, and even today they still have a mummer's parade. I think it's in Philadelphia, isn't it? Well, I was wondering where stockings came from. You know, hanging stockings up, it seemed a little strange. And I read a little bit about that, and I found out that Sinterklaas, or St. Nicholas, Santa Claus, whatever, was going through his act one year of putting things in the shoes, and I guess he got pretty good at that, so he started flipping things into the chimneys. And in one home, anyway, some folks had hung their stockings underneath the fireplace to dry them out overnight, and the stuff he was flipping in was landing in the stockings, and that's where we got stockings. Not very theological, is it? Christmas cards began in 1846. They were printed in London by a very enterprising man named Sir Henry Cole, who was the owner of an art shop and saw it as a way to make a lot of money. And all the first Christmas cards printed for him were printings of drinking scenes. What a mess, frankly, Christmas is. No wonder so many people miss Christmas. With all the paraphernalia and the trappings around it, the simplicity of the birth of Christ is literally drowned in a sea of paganism. You say, well, I guess it's true that today people miss Christmas, and all you have to do is look around and you know it, don't you? Busy, doing all kinds of things, but missing Christ. You want to know something? If you think it's something that had happened today, I want you to know, and we're going to go right back to the Bible, that when Christmas happened in Bethlehem, most people missed it then too. Turn with me to Luke chapter 2 and verse 7. Luke chapter 2 and verse 7. Now I want you to think with me as we look at this truth. This is the story, of course, in Luke 2 of the birth of Christ. And I just want you to look at verse 7. And we're only going to pick out some highlights to illustrate this matter of the people who missed Christmas. Verse 7. Speaking of Mary, it says, "And she brought forth her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling cloth," really. They weren't clothes at all. They were just long strips of cloth. "And laid him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn." Now, the first person that missed Christmas was the innkeeper. The innkeeper missed Christmas. It was right in front of him, but he missed it. He had to confront a pregnant woman and her husband, but he had no room for them. And so he missed it. Look back at verse 7. He not only missed it by not letting them in to stay with him, but he missed it by being so indifferent that he doesn't even appear to have called for any help for Mary when she gave birth, because verse 7 is markedly concerned with a lonely birth. A lonely birth. We don't even know where Joseph was. If I know anything about fathers at the time of births, especially young fathers like Joseph, who could have been as young as 15 or 16 years of age, he would have been little help at all at this time. And so it writes, "She brought forth her firstborn son." Who did? She did. Middle Eastern people are hospitable. Jewish people are kind and caring people. They were not barbaric people. They were not the kind of people that we might have read about in the Aboriginal tribes that sent their women off into the jungle to have their babies on a great big banana leaf or something. These people are civilized, intelligent, educated people who understand about human life. These are not the kind of people who are going to leave a woman alone, or are they? Mary brought forth her own son. And then it says, she wrapped him in swaddling cloth. Mary did. Where were the midwives? Where were the people who are supposed to care for things like that? Where was the innkeeper? Didn't he know anybody that could help? Didn't his wife concern herself with this? Or wasn't there some source of assistance to Mary? Ah, but then after all, hadn't the prophet said he would be despised and rejected? And wouldn't it be true that this could even be the case at his very birth? And it says, she laid him in a manger, an animal feeding trough. Swaddling cloth, by the way, were long strips of cloth, and when an infant was born, immediately the infant was wrapped, its limbs and its body, in this swaddling cloth. And then, of course, in an outer blanket. That was the tradition. And certainly there would be a midwife to clean the baby and to do that. But no, Mary did that. This was a lonely birth. Now, I don't know anything about the innkeeper because the Bible doesn't say anything about him. He wasn't interested, so he's not even included. But it's interesting to think about the scene a little bit. Some people feel that the child was born in a stable, and we've seen pictures and cards of stables, which are just kind of lean-tos with a little roof and the animals are there. And others think he was born in a cave because there are many caves there, and the church of the Nativity, where Christ is believed to have been born in Bethlehem, is built over a cave. There are others who believe Christ was born in an open courtyard in the inn. There are others who say he was born out in a field. You want to know something? Nobody knows. Some who look at the word inn here, which is kataluma, note that it is not the normal word for inn. And that's true. There is a different word for inn. which means a hostelry, an inn with food and bedding and all of those things where there's a host. And that's not this word. But the word kataluma is used in Luke 22:11 to speak of the guest room in a home. And so some feel that what really happened was Joseph and Mary were coming along to Bethlehem anticipating that they were going to stay with some friends or relatives or acquaintances and that they would use their guest room. But the hospitality was not available to them for perhaps the reason that the guest room was already occupied. And so maybe it was some friends they were counting on whose guest room was occupied. Maybe it was an inn that had no room. Some commentators go even further and say the word kataluma was used primarily to speak of a lean-to that was built in the out-of-doors into which people could simply go for shelter. It was just a wall and a top, and you just took your animals in there for shelter in the coldness of the night, and nobody cared for you, and there was no water there, and there was no nothing, but people would put them on their property to assist those who were traveling. We really don't know. Whether it was an innkeeper, whether it was a friend, whether it was simply a man on whose property was one of these little lean-tos, whether it was an open field, whether it was a courtyard, it's impossible to know. But whatever hospitality they may have sought or whatever hospitality they may have anticipated was unavailable to them. The word kataluma translates five different Hebrew words in the Old Testament, so it has a very elastic meaning and doesn't really help us at all. Whatever the situation, they were turned away. The innkeeper missed Christmas. And what amazes me is that he missed it, even though it might have happened on his own property. And I begin to think about why he missed Christmas. Simple answer. Preoccupation seems best to me. That seems to be it. Preoccupation. You say, what do you mean? Well, he was so busy. I mean, his inn was full, or his guest room was full, or all of his little lean-tos were full. Why? Because it was the census in Bethlehem, and the city was literally bulging with everybody who had any ancestry there, and they were coming to the city, and since it was the city of David, those who were in the line of David were there, and that's why Joseph and Mary were there, both coming from the line of David, one through Solomon and one through Nathan, and so there they were, and the city was bursting with people. And he was busy caring for his guests and his house and whatever situation he was involved in. And he wasn't hostile, and he wasn't unloving, and he wasn't unsympathetic, and he wasn't really indifferent. He was just busy. Just real busy. I guess there are a lot of people like that. The chambers of their souls are filled with needless things. Filled with human interests. They're filled with the stuff that doesn't matter, and they miss the Christ of God. Meaningless, needless, useless human interest squeezes out room for Christ. Our time is demanded by 1,000 other things. Our possessions, we're so busy figuring out what we want, how to get it at the cheapest price, buying it, taking care of it, polishing it, storing it, keeping it up. And then, of course, the games we play. We've got to be playing this and playing that, and that takes a lot of time. And then all of our pleasures and all of our passions and all of our parties and all of our preoccupation and all of our presents and all of everything that doesn't amount to anything. And we miss him, crowded out by a tyrant world that dictates to us what we will think and what we will do and what we will buy. And we march around with rings in our noses, pulled to those places that are needless. I have to admit this. It was an ignorant preoccupation on the part of the innkeeper. He didn't know. Ignorant preoccupation. I look at the world and that's what I see. They just don't know. They don't know what Christ is. They don't know who he is. They don't know why he came. They're just ignorant and ignorantly preoccupied with the mundane and the meaningless. Oh, how ridiculous it is to live your entire life in mundane, meaningless activity, wake up sometime in eternity without God, and look back over all of the waste. The innkeeper missed it. He was too busy. Look at your own life. Maybe you've been in the trap, too, where the innkeeper was.
That's host, John MacArthur, a pastor, author, and president of the Master's College and Seminary, both schools in Southern California. His lesson today on Grace to You Weekend, the people who missed Christmas. John, you know, the lesson listeners just heard is a good example of what they'd find most every day on Grace to You. You open the Bible, you teach verse by verse, and God works through His Word to change lives. What some listeners may never consider is how we're able to be here in the first place, and I know that you have a few timely thoughts on that.
I certainly do. I'm here because we have folks who sustain this ministry with their support, their prayer support, their financial support. We say very little about finances, but as we head into 2011, you need to know that we operate on what God provides through the people to whom we minister. It's listener-supported totally, totally. Our resources come from our listeners. And though there are millions out there who listen, there are a small number who sustain this ministry. We don't beg, and we live within what God provides. We don't go into debt. We just want to do what God enables us to do, and He does it through listeners like you. Your generosity comes to us and sustains this program, and it goes right through us into the extensive aspects of this ministry that cover the globe. So we're really a conduit. You know, we're kind of a pass-through. You send us your money to advance the name of Jesus Christ, and we'll use it to spread that name across the face of the earth. Wow, what a good partnership that is. So if God has used Grace to You in your life this year, this would be the time for you to respond with an investment that would be a great blessing to us and to people all over the world. Thanks for what you've already done, by the way. And whatever you can do to send us strong into 2011, we'll appreciate.
And a special word of gratitude if you're a Grace partner. Thanks for your faithfulness. Now, friend, through your faithfulness, we'll continue taking God's truth across the globe in 2011. To express your year-end support, please contact us today. Our mailing address is Grace to You Weekend, Post Office Box 4000, Panorama City, California, 91412. And the toll-free phone number, 1-800-55-GRACE. Thanks for your support and the support of folks like you. With it, we're able to send out free books or CDs every month by mail and broadcast John's verse-by-verse Bible teaching in communities like yours around the world. To stand with us, especially vital at the end of the year, please write to Box 4000, Panorama City, California, 91412, or call toll-free 1-800-55-GRACE. Now, if you're looking for Christmas gift suggestions, here are just a few. John's best-selling books, 12 Ordinary Men, and the other one, 12 Extraordinary Women. There's also the MacArthur Study Bible, or one of the volumes from the MacArthur New Testament Commentary Series. For any of these and a lot more, call us toll-free anytime, 24 hours a day, 1-800-55-GRACE, or order online at gty.org. And now, for John MacArthur and the staff, remember that you can see the Sunday telecast on DirecTV Channel 378, or watch it online at gty.org, where you can also get a station listing and broadcast times throughout the week. Then tune in Monday for the daily Grace to You broadcast where available, and join us here next week for another half hour of Unleashing God's Truth, one verse at a time, on Grace to You Weekend.